Howdy, y'all. Rish Outfield here, and you're listening to the Rish Outcast. And that music means this is part three of A Sidekick's Journey.
Fourth episode.
I'm presenting this.
No, this is the fourth episode, Rish.
I guess it's a novella.
Rish.
You could say it's a short novel, but I don't think it quite qualifies.
Rish, look at me.
I'm trying to do it in the summer.
It's like I'm not even here.
And it started raining, and I thought, oh, shoot, that's going to ruin this podcast. But then I decided, well, maybe it's ambiance. So I'm podcasting anyway. Do you hear it? I see people outside running for their lives. A man with two kids. He's got two children, so he's not able to shield either of them. It's kind of sad. The wind is blowing really hard, and the rain is just pissing down, as they say, in church. Because I'm not going anywhere, I might as well present the third part.
Fourth.
Of.
Number four. This is the fourth.
A Sidekick's Journey.
Fourth.
And I'm.
Oh, he's not listening again.
I really wanted a word, a single English word that meant second chance. Yeah, I wanted to call it second chance for a sidekick. Because essentially, Ben meets another version of the lean rider and gets to become a sidekick again. You know, sort of gets a do-over. Do-over of a sidekick. And I'm assuming, or he's assuming, that the adventures he goes on in this story is what he would have experienced with Jerome Cook in the natural course of time. But, you know, I feel like I'm talking and listening to the rain instead of letting you listen to the story. So let me go ahead and play it. I will meet you on the other side.
They made it to Phoenix, and Ben's knots held the dead man fast enough that the body was identifiable to Mr. Meldrum at the railroad station. He asked about the other Donovan brother, who was worth so much more, and Lorelei said he was more trouble, too. But her boss, the lean rider, was fast on his trail as they spoke.
"The lean rider?"
the railroad man said, impressed. He was an abnormally tall but frail-looking man, who hunched a bit in his clean suit.
"You think he'll be coming by today?"
"No way of knowing," Lorelei said. "But for that $500, I'm sure he'll try."
The tall man beamed at that, and Ben felt a bit sorry for Mr. Meldrum and his childlike excitement. Not that Ben couldn't relate. He thought about San Domingo, as he did every day, and would for years to come, and how the monjas were probably still telling the orphans, "One day, Señor Cook will come back for a new ayudante. If you work hard, maybe it will be you." Suddenly, tears threatened in Penny's eyes, and he turned his attention to the train schedule on the walls, noting departure times and wondering if he'd ever get to ride on one someday. Mr. Meldrum asked his wife, a plain woman with what appeared to be a real flower in her hair, to fetch the reward money. And only then did he notice Ben.
"Good morning, young man. What was your part in all this?"
The boy opened his mouth to answer, then closed it again. He'd pulled the trigger, taken a life. But was that something to be proud of, or something shameful to keep secret? His mouth was open, but he said nothing. The tall man grinned harmlessly.
"You don't have to be scared of me. I'm big, but mighty soft. Hey, you wouldn't happen to be one of the rider's sidekicks from San Francisco's orphanage?"
Ben didn't correct the man.
"Yes, sir."
"Well, I'll be."
The grin only got bigger, all the way down to the corners of Meldrum's eyes.
"Just like Whistlin' Angus and Blondie and Handsome Jim."
"Handsome Jack,"
Ben thought, but did not say.
I guess so.
Well, you sure are in good company, young man, the railroad man said. I have the Lean Rider adventures sent down as soon as they come out. Read 'em to the whole family.
He laughed.
I think my boy sometimes wishes he was born an orphan, just for the chance to do what you do.
Ben nodded politely. He could feel Lorelei next to him, the warmth radiating off her, and something else. Impatience? Anger?
Would you like an all-day sucker?
Meldrum asked the boy.
No, thank...
Ben began, then changed his mind.
Yes, sir.
I'll have my wife run out and grab you one.
He chuckled.
I sure would like to hear one of your stories, if you're of a mind. One of the adventures that hasn't made it to the magazines yet.
Ben didn't think he had any stories in him. Except that he did. Tales for a new series. The Adventures of the Veiled Ranger, maybe.
Miss Scruggs here has traveled with Senor Cook a lot longer than I have. She got rescued by him one time, and then probably rescued him right back.
You don't say,
Meldrum said, turning his attention back to the woman.
Though I find it hard to believe Cook would ever have to...
He stopped talking.
Why, you're bleeding, miss.
Lorelei was, of course, unreadable under her face covering, but by her posture, she wasn't feeling too good right now. She managed. There were three or four bright droplets of blood on the hardwood floor, right by Lorelei's boots.
She got shot,
Ben blurted out,
through the arm, by the other Donovan brother.
You don't say,
the man repeated, then shouted,
Merrily, Merrily, I need you.
His wife came out a moment later, the flower she wore bobbing.
Everything all right, hon?
Meldrum looked at the floor, then back at Lorelei's arm.
We have a room in the back where you can get tended to. My wife can fetch the doctor.
No, I'll be okay. Maybe just sit down for a minute.
Lorelei's voice sounded funny, like she was half asleep.
Is the bullet still in there?
Meldrum asked.
Our doc's real good. He was in the army back in...
It went straight through,
Ben said. But now he could see blood, fresh blood, all down her sleeve and running down the side of her duster. Guess he hadn't bandaged it so good after all.
We best get you looked at,
Mrs. Meldrum said, coming around the counter toward her.
We know a man who lost his arm just that way.
Well, that was an arrow,
Meldrum said.
But that sure was a nasty business.
I don't...
Lorelei began, and she began swaying on her feet.
Maybe I could use a little whiskey, you know?
Mrs. Meldrum looked at her husband, who nodded, apparently giving her permission.
We'll have our boy fetch you some, after he gets the doctor.
Lorelei grumbled from beneath her veil.
Whiskey's more important than the sawbones, mister,
she said, and Mr. Meldrum had no response to that.
I could look over your injury,
volunteered Mrs. Meldrum,
though I haven't been much use as a nurse in 20 years or so.
Lorelei didn't argue, and allowed herself to be led to the back of the railroad office. Ben stood there, awkwardly, wondering if he should follow Lorelei back or run fetch the doctor himself. He looked at the floor. There was a lot of blood there now. Too much to be called drops. Maybe a puddle.
Do you have something we can clean this with?
He asked, wanting to be useful. Meldrum stared at the blood, paling. Maybe he would pass out too.
Yes, I'll have my wife. I'll do it,
Ben said. Meldrum muttered,
Closet,
then went to the window, which he opened. While Ben was wiping up the blood, which came off the wood with surprising ease, a tall, skinny young man came in, son of the railroad owner, no doubt. He held a little bottle of amber liquid.
Watch your step,
Ben said, holding up the stained rag. Whatever squeamishness Mr. Meldrum had been suffering before seemed to be gone now, and he directed the whiskey delivery through the back toward his patient.
"Do you need any help?"
Ben called, but was ignored. He might not have been able to do anything. Hold Lorelei's hand, maybe. But he wanted to do something. Solve problems, instead of worrying about them. 16. After a minute or two more, Ben stepped outside the station. Phoenix was a big city, bigger than he'd ever seen, and he marveled at all the coaches and buggies moving up and down the main thoroughfares farther east. The railroad station and its adjoining buildings were on the outskirts of town, but he could hear horses and people and work being done, and see all those buildings, some 3 or 4 stories high. He heard a noise at the side of the station and walked over to investigate. The railroad man's son had untied and unrolled the blankets Leonard Donovan had been wrapped in and was shaking one out. It was covered in sand and rocks and burrs and stickers and would be of no use to anyone, not even as a horse blanket. The kid heard Ben approach and asked him,
"What happened to your ma's face?"
Ben just stared. Nothing had happened, as far as he knew. She'd gotten sick, left her boy with the church, and had died 2 months... Oh. The tall boy meant Lorelei. Ben didn't know what to say, but his ears burned as though he'd been told how handsome he was.
"Nothing. She just sunburns real easy."
The railroad kid looked disappointed to hear it, then shook the blanket a couple more times, as if that would make it usable again. In another 20 minutes, Lorelei Scruggs came out of the railroad station. She had an envelope in her hand, and the blood had been cleaned from her duster.
"Are you okay?"
Ben asked.
"Right as rain,"
she said, and there was just a bit of slurring to her voice. She wasn't carrying any bottles.
"Well, Ben, where to now?"
she asked. He didn't know. Was there a way to track Johnny Donovan?
Were there any clues inside the house?
He asked, trying to think of what the lean rider would do in the stories.
What kind of clues? Like a train ticket or a letter from someone in another town? Not that I recall. Anything else?
Ben couldn't see her expression to know if she was having fun at his expense or if she really wanted his suggestions.
"There was that woman." "What woman?" "That ran out the back."
Lorelei turned back the way they came.
"You want to ask her?" "We could," he said. "Or do you just want to see a woman running around with no clothes on?"
Ben grimaced. He couldn't respond to that. But Lorelei laughed. She was making fun of him.
"Okay, then," he muttered. "What should we do?" "Damned if I know, kid,"
she said, sighing.
"I lost my horse today, got shot through the arm. You said it didn't hurt, and I only got $50 for my trouble, which I have to split with you."
Ben couldn't tell if she was just grousing or if she was actually upset about that.
"You don't have to split it with me,"
he said. He had plenty of money back in town.
"Santa Fe is where they did most of their troublemaking," Lorelei murmured,
and he realized she was talking about the Donovans.
"Maybe they'd go back there. Maybe Johnny's here in Phoenix right now. It's a big place." "How bad is your arm, really?"
Ben asked. He wondered if the doctor was nearby and what Mr. Meldrum's wife had been able to patch up. Most likely she had recommended Lorelei get it looked at by a professional, or at least get some sleep. Lorelei stayed silent for a while, watching a wagon go by, with at least 10 children on it, all under Ben's age.
"Look, I'm a bit sore and a bit tired. I'll tell you what, I found some banknotes in a cigar box in the house back there. If you can guess how much it was, we'll spend the day here in town and get some rest. Have the doc stitch up my arm. Get a bath. Maybe a nice meal. Donovan's cigar box will pay for it. And if I can't guess? Then we head back to Trueno, tired and dirty. What if I get close?
She didn't consider long.
Close is close enough. What if... Just guess, Benny, all right?
She sounded really tired now. Or sore. Or just plain sick of him. He couldn't know without her taking off that veil and showing her expression. Her half-expression, he mentally amended. Ben tried to guess how much she had found. If it was enough to pay a doctor, eat a meal for two, get a room and a bath. But she had complained about the $50, so he didn't think it was nearly that much.
$15?
Ben said. She just looked at him, saying nothing.
Well? Well, it was 13, and about a dollar in coins. That's pretty darn close.
Ben nodded. They untied the donkey and pony and walked with them down the street to an inn they had passed on the way to the train station. Lorelei went in, having Ben stand outside, the sun mighty hot on his neck and back. An old Mexican woman came by with a basket filled with tamales, and Ben's mouth filled with saliva at the smell of them. But he had no money with him, and he didn't even know if Lorelei was hungry. By the time she came out of the inn, with directions to the doctor's office, the tamale salesman was gone. There were two tubs in the back room of the inn, both filled with hot water by the time they got back. The doctor had been a real talker, running his mouth every second they'd been in his office. He was able to sew up the entrance wound in Lorelei's arm, but the exit wound was beyond fixing.
"Not unless you want to put a cork in there or something,"
the Sawbones had chuckled, glancing at the woman's chest for the fifth or sixth time. Ben kept watching out the window, trying to get a look at the town, the largest buildings he'd ever been around, but really only seeing the back of a place that made tables and chairs and woodworks, a store just for that, that had nothing more than sawdust barrels in the back. Lorelei had a silver flask of something she had taken from the Donovan house and kept swigging from it as the doctor patched her up. This was on top of the whiskey she'd drank at the railway station. She saw Ben looking over and offered him a drink. It smelled god-awful, and he turned back to the window.
"Look,"
she said when they got back to the inn,
"if I don't take a bath right now, I'm going to fall asleep without one. So you can either wait until I get done, or you can be in there with me." "The bathtub?"
Ben asked, his eyes threatening to double in size.
"There's two bathtubs, Slowpoke,"
she said, slurring a little.
"I'll be fast, but you may need some reheated water by your turn."
So it looked like they were bathing separately. Ben was a little relieved at that, but only a little. He waited in the room, which had two beds that could be pushed together, and a window that overlooked Town Square, which had a big podium where speeches could be made or hangings could take place. In the room next door, a woman was either laughing or crying. Ben couldn't tell which. There came a knock at the door, and Ben's first inclination was to grab one of Lorelei's pistols. Donovan could have found them. She must have thought the same thing, because one of the firearms was downstairs with her. Ben hefted the other one, pointing it at the door.
"Who is it?"
he asked in his bravest grown-up voice. But it was a little girl bringing roast chicken and potatoes on a plate.
"Your ma told me to bring these up,"
the girl said with a nod. She didn't see the pistol Ben hid behind his back.
"Oh, thank you."
"She's the lean rider's wife, then?"
"What?
And you're his son?"
Ben wished.
"No, we just help him on missions and such."
The girl looked at Ben with unashamed awe.
"That's so exciting. Your ma said she got shot stopping a train robbery."
Yep,
Ben said.
"That's right."
"My, oh my,
The little girl was 9 or 10 at the oldest, but she curtsied and said,
"Is there anything you need?
Water, please."
"You want me to come inside?"
the girl asked.
"Excuse me?"
"I'll get you your water,"
she said, now seeming embarrassed. Ben pondered that and put the pistol back under Lorelei's bedroll where he'd found it. He sat down on his own bed and started to go over the adventure they'd had. He'd shot a man, shot him dead. But if he hadn't? Either he was exhausted or the bed was very, very soft, because the next thing he knew, Lorelei was trying to wake him for his bath.
"Water should be ready for you,"
she said, hanging a towel on the back of the door. She was wearing a borrowed house dress while her bloodied clothes were being laundered.
"If you want, they'll wash your shirt for you too, kid."
Ben hadn't noticed, but he had bloodstains on the sleeves and one side of his old tan shirt, now dried to brown. XVII. Ben slept well that night, in the soft, fluffy bed. He did wake up once with a gasp, imagining Johnny Donovan peering over him. Only in his dream, he had Jerome Cook's dead face and a bullet hole in the neck. But no one was around, and this time, Lorelei did not stir from where she lay in her own bed. He could barely make her out in the dark room, turned away from him and quietly snoring. He watched her shoulder rise and fall as she breathed, and had an odd sensation of gladness at knowing she was there. This was how it was going to be, he realized, and smiled. To live this life of adventure with a brave hero like her was worth getting shot at from time to time. Maybe he'd end up injured on their next mission, like she had been. But if that was the case, he'd live with it. Or not live with it, he supposed, if his luck ran out. He'd gotten his wish, just a little later than he'd wanted.
Ben.
Lorelei was shaking him gently.
Benny, let's get up now.
He opened his eyes. The sky outside the window was gray, but with a hint of orange there, and he realized it was just about dawn. He yawned and got out of bed.
"Can I use the privy before we go?"
he asked.
"Of course not. I'm a monster, kid."
But she laughed under her veil, and he smiled, aware he'd have to learn her tone of voice to tell when she was joking and when she was serious.
"The worst monster,"
he agreed, and slipped on his now clean riding shirt. Their shadows long, the two of them rode back toward Trano, Lorelei on the donkey, and Ben on pony.
"If Donovan had shot the mule, too, would you really have cut his brother's head off?"
Ben asked, before they even hit the outskirts of town.
"With what?"
she asked, not looking over.
"Do you have a knife that will cut through bone?"
Ben nodded at that, a bit relieved. He wondered how strong you had to be to cut somebody's head off. He'd read about knights of old doing it with swords or scimitars. Of course, David had done so with the giant Goliath in the Bible story, and they said Indians could do it with tomahawks. But Ben had once seen a pig slaughtered for a 4th of July celebration, and its head absolutely would not come off, to the point where Padre Puente gathered the boys up and made them go watch something else. Many orphan boys had awakened from nightmares that night, Ben among them, hearing the squeals and screams of the animal as it died.
"You all right, kiddo?"
Lorelei said from beside him.
"You don't get to be squeamish in our line of work."
He remembered the blood flowing from Leonard Donovan's chest and clenched his jaw. She was right. Still, he couldn't stop thinking about it. A day ago, he was an 11-year-old boy, a little kid. And now, he had killed someone. He told her so, his voice catching on the K word.
"Yeah,"
she said, staring upward rather than over at him.
"Everybody dies, Ben Parks. And some men gotta meet their maker sooner rather than later. And that scattergun he was holding might have taken me out if he'd managed to pull the trigger. I know, but..."
She didn't let him finish.
"You did fine, though, when it counted. Even in the doctor's office. You watched him stitch up my arm instead of looking at the walls."
She made a chuckling sound.
"Or down my shirt, like the doc did."
The boy smirked. He hadn't imagined Lorelei noticed the man's wandering gaze. Even Ben had admired her smooth arms and unmarked back, though now he felt a little embarrassed about it.
"How is your arm?"
he asked.
"Oh, great," she replied.
Again, he couldn't know for sure, but it was unlikely that was the truth. They approached the same homestead where they'd found the Donovan brothers the day before, and Ben wondered if they should stop by.
"Not a bad idea," she said.
But as they neared it, the back door was still sitting wide open, and Lorelei said not to bother going inside.
"He'd have to be pretty dim to come back to the same place, I guess,"
Ben observed.
"Yeah, well, a lot of times outlaws ain't exactly doctors and lawyers, Ben,"
she said from atop the donkey, which tended to want to go where it would rather than where she led it, enabling Ben to ride side by side with her instead of always trailing behind.
"Of course, the man who shot Jerome Cook was probably an exception,"
she added.
"No," admitted Ben. "He wasn't too bright. Just got lucky."
She looked over at the boy for a moment, then said,
"What were his last words?"
"Segovia? He got hanged and said..."
"No, Cook. I don't recall. He didn't really get a chance to know he was dying, you know?"
"Of course he didn't," she muttered.
"Did you..."
Ben began, unsure how to phrase it.
"Were you sweethearts? Me and Cook?"
she asked, laughter in her tone.
"We... I don't know. He sure would have liked to be, back when I was pretty. He was tall and thin, more skinny than lean, and I didn't..."
Her words fizzled out, the donkey starting to wander off to the right. She did nothing to correct it. Ben didn't know what to say. After a minute, she mumbled,
"Yeah, well, afterward, when I wasn't so high and mighty, he looked a lot better. Do you know what he said to me? He said, 'I bet if you smile, you'd look just the same.' Well, it was a line, I suppose. But I didn't care. I was hurting so bad that I would have fallen for any halfway decent compliment. I didn't care where kindness came from. I'd just take it. But he didn't treat me no different from the way he did before. Said I was beautiful. Said I was special. He..."
She trailed off. Permanently this time. And by the time she got the donkey back in the right direction, Ben still by her side, she had apparently reached the end of her talkative phase. A few minutes later, Ben saw circling buzzards up ahead and hoped they weren't eyeing a dead person. Unless Lorelei had somehow shot Johnny Donovan, the same as he'd hit her, and he'd bled to death out here. In which case, sure, it was fine if they were circling a body. Of course, if the carrion birds got him, Lorelei wouldn't be able to collect the reward money, so that wouldn't be so great either.
"Lorelei?"
he asked, glancing over, meaning to ask about the chances she'd put a hole in Johnny as well. But what came out was...
"What happened to your face?"
There. He'd said it.
There are certain things you're not supposed to ask a lady, Benny. Like her age, or if she was ever a whore, or...
Lorelai sighed, almost melodramatically.
But I don't suppose I'm a lady, am I?
Ben couldn't respond to that. She exhaled behind her veil.
Another time, okay, boy? Why don't you sing me a song? Something you like.
Ben started in on the Battle Hymn of the Republic, though he got a few of the words wrong, since he was used to singing it in Spanish once Sister Cassidy left. Her Español had been almost hilariously bad. He petered out after the first verse, and had to do the rest of the second in Spanish, then did the glory, glory, hallelujah part again in English, and went silent. The sun was starting to bake down on him, and he wondered if Pony was suffering from the heat. There weren't a lot of lakes, rivers, or watering holes between here and home.
Thank you, Ben,
Lorelai said from beside him. His horse and her donkey were about the same height, so they were at the same level.
Huh?
He asked.
That was nice.
He smiled. It was nice. She was looking over at him, and he thought he felt her smile too, even though he couldn't see it. Suddenly, the heat of the sun wasn't uncomfortable, and he felt at ease and at peace. He reckoned he could ride all the way to California side by side with Lorelai Scruggs, and he wouldn't complain. That didn't sound like a bad life to Ben. 18. They saw the smoke before they reached Troino. Lorelai started her donkey moving faster, and Ben caught on.
Trouble?
He asked.
I don't know. Maybe.
They rode as fast as their tired mounts were able, seeing the ruins of the saloon as they neared the main street through town. Its top story was a charred, blackened shell, but the bottom was salvageable, unlike the other two buildings the fire had taken. Ben recognized them at once. Ms. Aubrey's boarding house and the sheriff's office. Lorelai muttered something, and Ben pulled his gaze from the smoking pile of boards and ash to look at her.
What did you say? No accident,
she repeated. Down the street, three dead horses were piled up beside the general store's corner, a couple of feed sacks on top to, unsuccessfully, keep the flies away. No people seemed to be around. The owner of the tavern, his clothes and hands covered in soot, stepped out of the saloon as the pair went by.
A little late, wouldn't you say? He growled.
What happened here?
Lorelai asked.
Where's the lean rider? The barman demanded. I want to talk to Jerome Cook.
He's busy, Lorelai all but spat. What happened?
Ask the sheriff. He's at the docks. If he's still kicking.
Ben asked it this time.
What happened?
We had a visitor come to town. He was a friend of yours.
Ben was confused. Lorelai was staring in the direction of the burned Ms. Aubrey's.
Was it Johnny Donovan?
I don't know his name, except you riled him up something fierce.
The bar owner wiped at his nose, leaving it streaked with black.
He demanded to know about a kid and a lady with her face covered, coming from Troino. My bartender wouldn't say, so he shot him. I ran to get the sheriff. His deputy went in there, didn't come out. One of the girls told him what she knew. Then your friend started the place burning.
The barman chuckled, but it was a disturbed sound, with no humor in it. His eyes fixed on Benny's.
He walked over to where you live and burned that place, too.
The sheriff... Did Miss Aubrey get hurt?
Nah, she was visiting her sister in Flagstaff. Still is.
Ben nodded, only slightly relieved.
Deputy Anglesworth, Is he burned up?
Yeah, but he didn't feel nothing.
Ben squinted at the thought of that.
The gunman shot him right in the chest, Arlene said.
Lorelai put a hand on Ben's shoulder, then addressed the barman, her voice sharp.
The outlaw, where did he go?
The man sighed.
Oh, he started my place on fire, and then went out and started on Mrs. Aubrey's. It was burning good and hard when the sheriff finally showed up, him being holed up with that girl of his the whole time. He shot at the killer, missed, then the killer shot a bunch of times, right across the street there.
He gestured to the boarding house's remains.
The young guy didn't miss.
Ben's cheeks felt wet, and he touched them before he realized he was crying.
Sheriff Murtry's dead?
He asked in the voice of a much younger child.
Doubt it. Somehow Doc Youngstrom got the bleeding stopped. Says he'll probably pull through. One in the belt buckle, one in the leg, one in the shoulder is all. But you never know. Men died from less.
Ben's tears only increased at this news, though he couldn't say why. Something in the boy's face must have affected the man, so he turned his gaze on the woman.
Your outlaw. Donaldson, you say?
Donovan,
Lorelai said in a small voice.
Donaldson started the sheriff's office burning, and then the bastard went and shot the three horses in front of the general store. Just out of meanness.
He made that almost laughing sound a second time.
Where did he go?
Lorelai asked, although if she hadn't, Ben would have.
Hell if I know. He hopped up on his big horse and rode north. Shot out the window in the schoolhouse on the way, they say.
He turned toward where the outlaw had gone, but there was no one in sight in that direction.
Thanks for telling us,
Lorelai said and turned, wandering away toward the burned boarding house. The bar owner, ex-owner now, followed them for two or three steps.
Hey there, woman! You need to fetch Jerome Cook back from whatever he's doing for the government and get him after that killer. This ain't a job for a lady and a kid.
Will do, she muttered.
There was still smoke rising from the ashes of the once two-story building. Apparently, they'd tended to the tavern fire first, probably because its owner was whole and insistent.
I want to check on the sheriff,
Ben said, and got a shrug from Lorelai, standing by Miss Aubrey's, shaking her head. She was taking this badly.
What is it?
He asked. This time, it was her who sounded much younger than her years.
All my money, all my belongings were in that room. Everything except my horse. And I lost that yesterday. I'm sorry,
he muttered, remembering how she'd arrived with her horse and a packed donkey. It hadn't occurred to him that she didn't have a home somewhere, waiting for her to return to it.
Yes, well, the Lord giveth,
she said, quietly. Her face, of course, unreadable.
Go to your friend, Ben,
she said a bit louder. And there were tears in there, in her voice.
And we're back. I'm still sitting here in the rain. It's afternoon, but it's so dark because of the clouds and the downpour that you'd think that it was almost night, that the sun had gone down. And yet this story, oh, I saw lightning. This story takes place in the desert in Arizona. And my mom came north from Mexico. She was born in Chihuahua, Mexico, and she and her family immigrated to the United States, and they crossed over in Arizona, and she lived in Mesa, Arizona for a few years, and so I've sort of felt a kinship to that place. We all went on a family trip there when I was a teenager, and we saw where they had lived and the family that took in my grandmother and all of her kids until they could find a place of their own. And I don't know, for some reason that stuck with me, that, you know, that that area of Arizona was exotic or romantic or neat in some way. I had just gotten my driver's license and my mom let me drive the car in Arizona. I think we went to the grocery store or something like that. And that felt really exotic to me too, that I was in a strange city and yet I was driving. Other than that, there's not really any reason that these stories take place in Arizona. I try to have some kind of loose historical accuracy in these stories, but I don't want to be tied down. Well, maybe I'm just lazy and I don't want to do the research. In the one I'm writing right now, I had a line about Mary Todd Lincoln, you know, that her husband was dead and that she was the widow Lincoln. And just as a lark, I thought, well, I'll look her up and see how old Mary Todd would have been when this story took place. And yeah, she would have been dead for 40 years. And so I was like, oh, okay, shoot. And that sort of ruined the part I was writing, because you had to know, like, who is the most famous widow in America at that time. And I just assumed it would be Mary Todd Lincoln. But I had to change it to Lucretia Garfield, who was President Garfield's widow. And that always bothered me. For the reader to get anything out of that reference, Ben would have to put two and two together of what... It sort of impeded the line of dialogue. But I wasn't going to leave it as Mary Todd Lincoln, because that's such an anachronism that I thought, well, okay, I mean, we just end up with a slightly less effective sentence there. You can really, like, bury yourself in accuracy, in historical accuracy, and trying to come up with things that would stand up to scrutiny. But these stories aren't really meant to be taken as historical fact. These are supposed to be like little fables, and maybe not children's stories, but, you know, pulp entertainment. And that's cool. I mean, there's certainly something to be said for that. You know, it's like you watch Star Trek or you watch... Well, Star Trek is probably not as good an example as Star Wars. You watch Star Wars and, you know, there's reference to light speed and parsecs and TIE fighters explode in balls of fire. And they're not meant to be scientifically accurate. They're not meant to be even science fiction. They're meant to be fantasy films. And trying to translate that into something that would hold up with science would take a great deal of the fun out of the story. You know, just like how lightsabers work and things like that. When you read the explanations, you're like, yeah, okay, I can buy that. But the smarter you are, the more scientifically versed you are, the more you would have to just not only suspend your disbelief, but bury it. I don't know. I want these stories to be fun, but there's always a sense of tragedy to them. Because Banny is sort of a tragic character. I was talking to another writer who writes like several series. And the only character, like continuing character that I have is Ben Parks. And I know a little bit about him. He's just an inherently good person. Optimistic, decent, hopeful person. And the world that he lives in is a hard world and a rough one and occasionally unfair. You know, maybe everybody's life is unfair. Like right before I started recording this, I was trying to get off the freeway and the car next to me was not slowing down enough that I could get in the lane. And I just waited and I was like, gosh, what is going on? And it was a very, very elderly lady driving a car and she started to pull into my lane. And if I hadn't looked over, like, why is she not letting me in? She would have hit into me. And so I had to pull away so she didn't hit me and I missed the exit completely. I was angry for a few seconds and then I thought, well, if I hadn't been looking over, wouldn't she have just driven right into me? And how much worse would that be? And then it started to rain hard. And think, you know, you damaged your car and you're out there on the freeway in a car accident with weather like this. That could have been bad.
So a second ago I said that, you know, these were pulp adventure stories. They're also sort of dramas. Western, obviously. But me being a horror writer, sometimes I think about inserting horror elements into the story. I mean, it's not outside the realm of possibility that Ben Parks would have a scary adventure, or even some kind of run-in with the supernatural. And the story that I'm writing right now takes place a few months later than the one you're hearing, and it's introducing a supernatural element into these stories, and I sort of debated mentally whether I would do that or not, because it seems like, well, you're changing things. But that's sort of where the story wanted to go, and it'll be up to you to determine whether that was successful or not, or whether I would have been better off without it. But I wrote this one early 2015, and I was toying with the idea of writing a novel. I wanted to see if I could do it. I did end up writing a short novel called Into the Furnace, and it certainly has a supernatural element to it. And I was told to call it a weird Western, and I wonder how weird an experience Ben would have for one of these stories to be a weird Western. In 2017, I was on a commercial shoot, and they always say, you know, hurry up and wait. I had a tremendous amount of downtime, and I thought, you know, I'm going to write another Ben Parks story, because they'd been kicking around in my head ideas for a follow-up of, you know, what happens next. And I may have explained it to you before, I may not have, but I had this idea that eventually I would give Big Anklevich what he wanted, and we'd have a story called Death of a Sidekick. But Ben is not the sidekick that dies at the beginning of the story. It would be another one of Jerome Cook's sidekicks from earlier in his career that he had rescued from the orphanage. And maybe there's a letter to the Lean Rider. And those always go to Ben, those letters. And in the letter, one of Cook's old sidekicks is talking about that someone murdered a previous sidekick. And this person that's writing is afraid for their own life. And sure enough, this one is murdered too. And it turns out that there was a sidekick before Ben who went bad. And instead of sticking with it and making sure this kid shaped up, Jerome Cook just abandoned him in some frontier town or whatever. It's like, this is a bad kid. And so the kid did not improve after this experience. In fact, he becomes even more of a bad guy, until eventually he decides that what he's going to do is kill off the other sidekicks that Cook picked and did not abandon. And Ben ends up having to fight or defeat this ex-sidekick. Well, he's an ex-sidekick too. But as I was coming up with that story in my head, it just didn't feel right that Ben is 11 years old or 12 years old, and this 19-year-old, 18-year-old, however old the bad guy is, comes to town looking to murder him. It just, it's rough. And I wonder if J.K. Rowling, when she was writing the Harry Potter books, ever got any pressure, or whether it was internal pressure of, like, how much danger can you put Harry in when he's a little boy? I don't know what the answer to that is, because people try to kill him to murder him on more than one occasion in the first book. So she probably didn't pull her punches, or maybe she pulled her punches on how scary it would be. I don't know. But I decided that one day I would write a story about an older Ben, like a 16-year-old Ben Parks, and then he can have the confrontation with this bad sidekick. And that's still in my hip pocket. One day I'm going to write that story. I think it'll be A Sidekick's Revenge or something like that. I don't think it's going to be called Death of a Sidekick anymore.
Don't call me evil anymore!
But last year I did write a story set in the orphanage when Ben was smaller, when Ben was 7, I think, that introduced this kid that becomes the villain in a story I will write years from now, if all goes to plan. That was a story that I meant to release for Christmas, and I didn't do it because I read through when I was getting ready to put it out there, to publish it, and it didn't feel complete. It felt like a rough draft of a story where portions were incomplete, where things hadn't been filled in all the way. You know what I mean? Maybe you, if you're a writer, write very differently than me, but sometimes you'll summarize rather than write out what's going to happen. And then later, you know, you'll go back in and flesh that out. And that's what that story felt like to me. And then I got an idea after writing that of, okay, what the next big adventure for Ben was going to be. The story that takes place after the one that I'm presenting right now. And I thought, ooh, this is a really good idea. And I called Big Anklevich and I told him basically the whole idea from beginning to end. I probably spent 10 or 15 minutes telling him. He didn't jump up and down and say, oh, I can't wait to read this. You've got to write it. Which, of course, is what we all want to hear when we are pitching our stories to other people. But he did say, oh, hey, that sounds really solid. And I can't remember. He gave me some suggestion of something that I should incorporate into the story. And that one I haven't started on. Okay, well, that's not entirely true. I did start on it. I wrote like the first 3 paragraphs. But then I guess I decided I just didn't want to take on that big of a responsibility to write another novella. I mean, you're like, you've been listening to this, right? It's kind of media. It's not a book, but it is a book. And I just wasn't in a place where I felt like committing to a book. I just wanted to write a short story. And so I came up with a story that would take place after the other stories that I had come up with. So in the story that I'm writing right now, Ben is 12. And he encounters a man. He's sort of a flamboyant character. I'm calling him Mr. Sterling, Rodney, I guess. And he's a guy who talks a big game. And Ben, being young and naive, believes everything that Sterling says. He takes it at face value. Because naivete, even though we think of it as a terrible weakness in ourselves, is charming in a child. Innocence is charming. It's a valued commodity in a kid. The other day, I was driving my nephew and we passed a construction site. And I said, what is it they're building over there? And he said, I think the sign said they're building condoms. And yeah, that's funny to me that the kid would say that. That's the kind of charm that we value in kids. And so Ben still has that. Even though life is really doing its best to stomp that out of him, probably by the end of the 2018 story, most of Ben's naive optimism is going to be gone, sadly. But by the time the kid is 13, he's going to have the cynicism of an older person. Although, you never know. you know, a lot of times when people write the pulp stories about the same characters, there's no character development, really. You can read them in any order, and they don't grow, they don't change much from story to story. And there are still series that are like that. You know, the James Bond series is like that. The Indiana Jones series is mostly like that. And so, I don't know what's going to happen with future stories. All I know that is that I do really enjoy writing these, and this one that I've almost finished. On Saturday, I went to the library, and it was my intention to write for an hour or so, and I ended up really, really getting into it, finding myself inspired and anxious, not anxious, excited to be writing the story, and I would have plowed through to the end, except for on Saturdays, the library closes really early. And so before I knew it, there was the announcement that the library was about to close. Please take your books to the front. I was bummed out by that because it's like, no, if I had another hour, I think I would finish this thing. And it's probably a writer's duty to put themselves in a place where they can become that focused. They can become that inspired where they want to continue no matter how late it gets. So we'll see where that goes. We'll see what happens next. This was the third episode.
Fourth episode. Fourth.
Of A Sidekick's Journey. And I'm going to leave you now. But we'll be back in a few days for the final chapter. Hopefully you will be too. Thanks. I've been Rish Outfield. And take care, y'all.
Hello. This is fake Sean Connery. Rish is over at his rarely functioning computer, toiling on the next episode. Look at him. So sad. So deluded to think that what he does matters, that anyone cares.
I can hear you.
I'd almost feel sorry for him, if I weren't a figment of his fevered imagination.
Will you do the license already?
Yes, yes. The show you have just listened to is produced under what's known as a Creative Commons 3.0 license, in which you are free to download and share the files as you like, but you cannot change them, take credit for them, or attempt to sell them. I wouldn't take credit for them either.
Fake Sean, if you're not going to help...
Ah, I've hurt his feelings. Look, the lad tries so hard. I see him literally working on podcasts every single day of the week. And for what?
To be insulted by a bald, geriatric ex-celebrity?
Fair enough. So listen, if you appreciate any of what that silly sod does, I advise you to head on over to Patreon and support him. You can give him $1 an episode, can't you? Can't you spare one bloody dollar, you selfish pig-headed ingrate? The boy works his wee fingers to the
Fake Sean!
I'm just saying, the boy works hard for the money. So hard for you, honey. Couldn't you toss a pound or two his way to keep the ennui from overtaking him?
It already got me.
If any of what he does has ever made you laugh or feel better about yourself, and it most certainly does me, please support the lad. Is that better?
Yeah, I guess.
Oh, and thanks to Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com for his music. Now there's a real man.
Thank you.
Testing? That means I left the microphone on all night. Damn it. So that brings us to the end of this third...
Fourth
episode of Sidekick's Journey. The thing with...
Oh, he's not listening again.
Lorelei Scruggs is that I came up with the name years ago. Long ago, I thought...
It's like my third wife.
That it would be interesting to have...
Let me smack him up.
Hello?
Oh, now he pays attention.
Mom, is that you?